Welcome to the Experience Focused Leaders Podcast. My name is Alex Shevelenko. I'm CEO and founder of Relate2, and we are on a mission, both with the podcast and with Relate2, to bring the most important ideas to life. And how do we do that? We do that through amazing, immersive, engaging experiences that move your organization forward, move your customers forward, and move us as a society forward. So if you love ideas, if you love bringing these ideas to life, stick around. Also, at the end of the podcast, we'll reveal how you could potentially be a guest speaker on the podcast as well. Let's get started. Welcome to Experienced Focused Leaders. This is a very special, deeply personal episode for me. I'm honored to share with you the story of Alexandra Matvichuk, who is the head of Ukrainian Center for Civil Liberties, an organization set up 15 years ago to work for the protection of human rights in Ukraine. This is an organization, and Alexandra, that has won a Nobel Peace Prize of 2024. Time magazine has featured Alexandra's 100 most influential people. And former Secretary of State of the United States, Hillary Clinton, described Alexandra as, she said, she's the living proof that women are not just victims of war. They can be agents of peace and justice. So, Alexandra, welcome to the pod.
Thank you for the invitation.
Ordinary people can have much greater impact than they can have ever imagined. Can you share a story with our audience about ordinary people doing extraordinary things in Ukraine?
Let me start with the large-scale war which Russia has launched against Ukraine 3 years ago, because it was the time when not just Putin, but also our international partners were confident that Ukraine has no potential to resist to such enormous opposing power, because Russia has veto power in UN Security Council, nuclear weapon, 140 million of population, oil and gas, which means a lot of money, and a strong military potential. And that is why I was in Kyiv when Russian troops tried to circle my city. I refused to evacuate, and with a part of my team, we continued to do our human rights work. And I witnessed how international organizations, even international humanitarian organizations, evacuated their personnel. They left us alone, but ordinary people remained, and ordinary people started to do extraordinary things. It were ordinary people who helped to survive under artillery's fire. It were ordinary people who took people out from the ruined cities. It were ordinary people who broke through the encirclement to provide humanitarian aid. And suddenly it became obvious that ordinary people fighting for their freedom and human dignity are stronger than even the second army in the world. And this is my lessons learned in the whole life, because I'm a human rights lawyer, which means that I'm applying the law to defend people and human dignity. But very often I found myself in situation when the law doesn't work, when you can't rely on the legal instruments or security guarantees or international UN system of peace and security, but you can always rely on people. And that's why I wrote in my Nobel speech in 2022 that ordinary people have a much greater impact than they can even imagine, and mass mobilization of ordinary people in different countries can change the world history quicker than the UN intervention.
Let's talk about what people who are not in Ukraine, what can they do and what they've been doing? Obviously, we're talking in beginning of 2025, the political support in some of the countries is wavering, at least in some of the parties. for the situation in Ukraine. But I think on a human level, when we go beyond the politics, which is relatively easy to pontificate and talk about, when people hear the stories of everyday bravery, heroism, they want to, they're inspired by it, they want to support it. So what can people do? And I would say business leaders in particular, what can they do to support the cause of justice, the cause of dignity of human life, which is what you've been working on for in Ukraine?
Let me start with the context, because it's very important to understand what can be done. There are a lot of hope on new president administration in the United States because President Trump publicly declared that he will stop this war. But Russia started this war not because Putin wants to grab one more part of Ukrainian land, because Putin wanted to occupy Bakhmut or Avdiivka or in other cities, which before this large-scale war started was unknown to the Russians. Putin started this war because he wanted to destroy and occupy the whole Ukraine and go further. He wanted to forcibly restore Russian Empire. He think about his legacy, how he will ingrain his name in the world history. And the problem is that after this 10 years of war, after 3 years of large-scale war, after all human losses which Russia has, Putin didn't refuse from his goal because the human life is the cheapest resources in Russian state. And this is a context which we have to take seriously. We can't afford ourselves a wishful thinking because we are dying, because this is a war which is very bloody. And it's a good opportunity to tell that when you are in a war with a country like Russia, you need support. Because this problem can't be solved just in national borders. And something for what we are fighting for as Ukrainians has also no limitation in national borders because we are fighting for freedom. We are fighting for freedom and human dignity, and this thing has no limitation in national borders. And that's why, especially now, after the 3 years of large-scale war, when situation in Ukraine is not the news anymore, yesterday Russian deliberately hit Zaporizhia and killed and injured several dozens of people there in trolley, in hospital, in other civil objects. But this is not in use anymore. Especially in such circumstances, we need help. And I'm not the best person to tell the audience and people who are listening to this podcast what they can do because they know better. They know better. The only thing which I want to tell, we need your assistance. And there are hundreds and hundreds of ways how to be useful. Because people can write about what's going on, they can collect money, they can urge their government to provide more help, or do some other things which they want to do in order to be helpful. And why people sometimes ask me what we can do? Especially those who have already done a lot, because they ask me another question. Because they ask me how I, with my human efforts, can stop this Russian war of aggression against Ukraine. This is the real question what people ask, because when you face with the war as a challenge, as an existential challenge, you have such feeling that all your efforts are very modest.
Yeah,
Because you're
you're a little
human.
drop. You're a
Yes,
drop in the ocean of war.
you're like a drop in the ocean. And this
Yeah.
is very good that you mentioned this quote because this was a quote during the Revolution of Dignity 10 years ago when millions of people in Ukraine stood up their voice against former pro-Russian, corrupt, and authoritarian government. And they faced with systematic and large-scale state repressions. And it was also a situation when the law doesn't work and the whole state machine tried to liquidate peaceful protest, even physically. I was coordinator of civil initiative Euromaidan SOE at the time, and every day hundreds and hundreds of people who were beaten, arrested, tortured, accused in fabricated criminal or other cases passed through our care. And in order to overcome this Lord helplessness feeling, Ukrainian artists made a series of posters, and one of them it was poster of drop. And this title, exact title, "We are dropping the ocean," was written in this poster, which means yes, we are human being, we are not God, but together we are ocean, and together we can change the situation.
This is brilliant. On that note, you've shared previously story of what you did during Euromaidan, and it was when I was listening to it, it was an example of what an entrepreneur would do, where you've asked first for people, do they need help if they're in trouble, and then legal support, and then you realize that there were not many trained lawyers, and then once you had the people, you asked the people who are legally trained to support them. Do you want to tell us a little bit about what you're doing? Because I think, a lot of listeners are members of entrepreneurial community. And so you're an entrepreneur in the human rights work. So I think it would be inspiring to hear what you're doing.
It's a very good story because in that day when the huge peaceful protest started as a result of brutal dispersal of peaceful student demonstrator in the center of Kyiv, we have to conduct the seminar for regional activists. And when I came to the audience, people were disappointed and frustrated because it was obvious that we will not conduct seminar when just several hours police brutally beaten hundreds of students who sing in Ukrainian national anthem only because these students peacefully protested to build a country where the rights of everybody are protected. And I told to colleagues, which I have never met before, because it was a seminar for activists from different regions. So let's think what we can do as a civil activist, as a human rights defenders. If we will not elaborate, not invent anything, we will go and join the general protest. But probably we can find an added value. And we quickly understood that there is a gap between people who were beaten, arrested, and people who can provide legal assistance for these people. And we opened a Facebook page. We named it Euromaidan SOS because the whole protest, which started before, was called the student protest, was called Euromaidan. So we are Euromaidan SOS because we like a service to provide pro bono legal assistance. And we made a first post that. If you were beaten, if your relatives disappeared or were arrested, please call us to these mobile phones and we will provide a legal assistance to you or to your relatives pro bono. You can rely on us. And this was a rather tricky issue because I'm a lawyer, but I'm not an attorney. I have no license to operate in the court, and there is no attorney in the room of these regional activists. And that is why, just in 30 seconds, we posted another text. If your attorney, if your lawyer, if you want to provide legal assistance pro bono to the people who were brutally beaten just several hours before by police, please call us and we will connect you. And suddenly, this mechanism started to work. It was like a miracle because people started to call us and to say, we are lawyers or we are attorneys or I'm head of big legal firm. We want to help because it's injustice, it's unfair, it's brutal, it's cruelty. They beat children. We have to stop it. And we got also messages and calls for people who need such legal assistance. And you know what? I remember it was Saturday when we started this Euromaidan SOS initiative with these two posts. And we started to provide legal assistance to students who were brutally beaten previous night by police. But I have never imagined, in even a nightmare, that we will work 24 hours per day next several months. That every day, hundreds and hundreds of people who were beaten, arrested, tortured, abducted, accused in fabricated criminal cases will pass through our care. And finally, this pro-Russian corrupt authoritarian regime started to kill people. Peaceful, unarmed people in the center of Kyiv. I had never predicted such scenario.
By the way, those that are watching on YouTube, you probably saw me tearing up. Just for context, I was born in Ukraine, in Kiev, and one of my early memories is my parents sharing samizdat, which is kind of prohibited literature in the Soviet era, with me. Including, poems that were out of favor, like Yevtushenko's poem Yevgeny Babi Yar, and it was kind of written in this typewritten, kind of self-made writing, and passed around was a secret of air. Like, you don't talk about it at school. And I know you grew up with examples of dissidents, so maybe you could tell us, for those that have not lived under authoritarian regimes, how critical and important it is to do the work that you're doing.
It's very difficult to express this experience because people in stable democratic societies, they started to take a lot of things for granted. For example, their own security, their own freedom. Yes, democratic society are not perfect society. There are a lot of problems, but you are secure that if you post something critical in your social network, that next day the secret police will come to your home and arrest you and then imprison you without any ground and torture you and sexual abuse you and make your family as a hostage of your position. So it's very hard to explain what does it mean to fight for freedom in non-free or partially free societies for people who luckily have not such memories. And we are fighting to be in such societies as well, because all Euromaidan movement and now in this war with Russia, we are fighting for our democratic choice, like a chance to build a country where the rights of everybody are protected, government is accountable, judiciary is independent, and police do not beat students who are peacefully demonstrating. And we paid a rather high price just for this chance. And what I want to tell that unfortunately, there is nothing stable in our world, even for people who live in so-called stable democratic societies, because freedom is like an oxygen. When you get used to it, you think that it will be forever, but nothing will be forever, nor oxygens, nor human rights. We are doing our choice every day. And what I see in these sustainable democratic societies, that people start to put into questions the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. They start to put their decisions more on economic benefits, on some political or other interests, some if it's a state authority security concern or geopolitical issues, but not on values of
Human
freedom
values.
and human rights. And this is a problem. This is a huge problem because human rights and freedom are not attained once and forever. And when you base your decision only on this thing, like benefits, political interests, like some other issues, even if you benefit in short term, you will wait for catastrophe in the long term because only values provide this long-term perspective. And that's why it's very rational and pragmatic to build your behavior, to build your decision, to build your strategy of life on values as well, plus to economic benefits and so on and so forth.
So on that note, obviously, Ukraine being in a situation of war, countries that go through war are not known as the ones that are moving towards democratic processes. They tend to move to more authoritarian processes. The economies mobilize more centrally for security and other concerns. Press may be limited within the country. How are you fighting this tension, right? The within Ukraine of the country needing to mobilize, and obviously that has its own set of normal movements towards autocratic, delayed elections, and so on and so forth. And your mission of what Ukraine is in the war for in the first place, which is the freedom to self-determination and self-expression.
Oh, our world is very complex and our life is also very complex. And let me try to answer to this very complex question with a concrete example for what we are fighting for in this war with Russia, because this war started not in February 2022, but in February 2014, immediately when millions of people in Ukraine won and Revolution of Dignity succeeded. And we got our chance to make a democratic transition of the country because it's obvious that when authoritarian regime collapse, it will be not a miracle that in one day you will have a sustainable democracy. You have to invest a lot of efforts in daily work to build sustainable democratic state institutions, to reform your country, to build professional police service, to make economic changes and so on and so forth. So when we got this chance to work and to build our country, Russia invaded. And why Putin decided to invade Ukraine? There are a lot of misunderstanding about this because Russia tried to widespread the narrative that NATO threatened Russia and that's why Russia invaded Ukraine in 2014. But it's a bullshit, I'm sorry. In 2014, Ukraine was a neutral country. We have no intent to join NATO. Our neutrality was in our constitution. We changed our constitution after several years of war as a result of the war after Russia invaded. And now we want to join NATO because we want to have this collective security and to contribute into collective security as well, because now we have a strong army, one of the most stronger army in our part of the world, I mean in Europe. And all these 10 years, we have to do parallel two tasks. First, to defend our country, our freedom, our people, and our democratic choice. And also to make these democratic reforms, because we have no luxury to postpone it after the war period, because we have no idea. Either we are in the end of the war, in the middle of the war, just in the beginning of the war. So we have to change our legislation, our practice, our state authorities, and to transfer the country, which is difficult. It's difficult.
Difficult in a peacetime, and it's
Even in
probably.
peacetime.
Yeah.
In United States, it takes centuries, and you are still not satisfied, as I know. There are a lot of criticism about
Yes.
state work state in United States. But once again, we have only 10 years for this task, and we are moving in the right direction. And this is the complexity of the situation because we have to do these two tasks parallel, and war is poison. War is a poison for any democracy because war put survivor issues on the first place. And that's why we have to balance between these two logics, logics of the war and logics of democratization, try to survive and try to transfer our country. So it's not easy task, but we have this feeling of responsibility. And I think your podcast is about leadership, that responsibility is a first characteristic of what is leadership is about. We want to succeed. We don't want to give this task for our own children.
Beautiful. This underlying theme of bravely taking on very challenging tasks in challenging times is something that's obvious to anybody who's working with Ukrainians right now. So I'm very fortunate to have Ukrainian team members, and probably for everybody on our team, lots of other countries around the world, the most remarkable thing is how motivated, how positive, how committed to doing great work at work, but also committed to their community, their loved ones, to their country, they remain. And as you mentioned, unless you and they probably even learned to adapt it, so it's not as remarkable to them. But what are some of the most remarkable examples that you see of people stepping up and becoming leaders in the state? Because for if you're doing a startup, or if you're running initiatives at a larger company, to really do the important work, sometimes you have to do something that's impossible. And in many ways, I think we all realize that in the larger scheme, what's going on in Ukraine is kind of an impossible becoming possible. Tell us your, what stands out at you, whether in your organizations or other folks that you work with.
I want to explain that people in Ukraine are very ordinary, the same ordinary people as, for example, people in the United States. And people in Ukraine didn't choose to be heroes. But Russia invaded Ukraine, and we have no other choice. We have to resist. We have to resist and overcome our fear, discomfort, tiredness and all other things, because it's very difficult to be in large-scale war for 3 years when you go to bed and you have no idea whether or not you will get up next morning, because probably your residential building will be hit by Russian rockets this night. So it's very difficult circumstances for ordinary people. And you have a choice how to respond to such difficult circumstances. Because when I will never wish anyone to go through this experience, the dramatic times provide people a possibility to express the best in us, to reveal our best features, to be courageous, to fight for freedom, to make difficult but right choices, to take burden of responsibility, and to help each other. And in our Euromaidan SOS initiative, the vast majority of people who join to it, and we have thousands and thousands of volunteers around the whole country, were people without civil participation background, but they couldn't be indifferent in such circumstances. So we always have a choice how to react. And my main lessons learned, because I work with war crimes, which is very difficult part of the war, because it's not just about human dimension, it's about human pain. We are documenting not just violations of Geneva and Hague Convention, we document the tragedy of people and their families. And that is why in future, I want to forget a lot from this war, a lot of details of this war, because it's very painful for me personally. I'm also not a hero, I'm ordinary people. But I want to remember for ages what does it mean to be human? Because only when we help each other, only when people rescue their lives for others whom they never met before. Only in this acute moment, you have this understanding, what does it mean to be human? And this dramatic time provides a very important definition of hope. And you mentioned before the Soviet dissidents, and this is their definition. I just recently found it in the memories of Soviet dissidents, and then I found the same quote of Václav Havel, Czech dissident, and he wrote that hope, it's not a confidence that everything will be fine, but hope, it's a deep understanding that everything which we are doing have a meaning.
Want to focus on this communicating this meaning. And so you just said earlier, when Russia invaded, ordinary people started doing things they didn't expect to do. A lot of our audience are committed to communication in their organizations, in the world. And I just wanted to share some the communication that's in some ways very simple, but we discussed it earlier. Was you of an author who just self-published a book called Good Morning, Russia Invaded Ukraine, which is a collection of WhatsApp chats and the phone SMS screens of parents like when the war just happened, of parents asking, are you okay? Is everything okay? Loved ones trying to find each other. I'll screen share for the folks that are online, and we'll provide it in the notes. And it was so simple in some ways, to just see here's a Telegram message, and then it's translated from either Ukrainian or Russian into English here. But it created a deeply human understanding beyond numbers, beyond how many bombs have been dropped or drones that came in. It just created the sense of deep empathy to the human condition of going through war. What do you see as some of the most effective communications that you've produced in your organizations or you've seen other people do in making us feel like yes, we're the ocean and we can do something about it, and making this go beyond statistics and really something that impacts us and motivates us to see the humans behind the statistics.
Russia invaded Ukraine in 2014 not because Putin was afraid of NATO. Russia invaded Ukraine because Putin is afraid of the idea of freedom. The idea of freedom, which came closer to Russian borders. And in response, Russia used unbelievable violence in order to break people's resistance and occupy the country. So it's not just a war, it's a war where Russia used war crimes as the methods of warfare. So they deliberately provide the intense human suffering to civilian people. And that's why we have in our database more than 80,000 episodes of war crimes. We document how Russians deliberately shelling residential buildings, schools, churches, museums, hospitals, attack evacuation corridors, torturing people in filtration camps, forcibly taking Ukrainian children to Russia in order to provide them for Russian families for forcible adoption and brought them up as Russians. How they deliberately destroyed Ukrainian cultural heritage and Ukrainian occupied territories. They banned Ukrainian language and culture. They're abducting, robbing, raping, and killing civilians in the occupied territories. And we have more than 80,000 such stories. So, what I can do as a human rights lawyer, I communicate the stories. I try to show the price which people are paying very honestly just for a chance to build a sustainable democratic country. And this is my communication so-called methods, because I told the stories which we are documenting in our human rights work. But I think that the most impactful is when people come to Ukraine to see on their own eyes what does it mean. Because you can read news, watch videos, look, examine photos, even hear testimonies of witness or survivors of Russian war crimes. But it's very different impression when you came to Kyiv or to another cities and look on your own eyes what's going on. Hear people on the streets. This fill this atmosphere, and it's a life-changing experience. A lot of people who are skeptical or so-called indifferent, when they came to Ukraine, they changed their mind, because there are things which you can't transmit in digital way. Sorry, I believe in a rapid digital technological progress, but we are human, and some things are need to be experienced in order to understand their meaning.
How do we, how, let's say that we can't have everybody come to Ukraine right now. I'm going to quote you in your book, The Peninsula of Fear, that where you wrote, the communicative memory of lived experiences lasts only three generations. All that remains after that is whatever meanings we have brought to light, thought through, and recorded. So let's say even if we come and I come and we are, we have this firsthand experience, but what happens for our children, our children's children? How do we embed the meaning into what's happening? Maybe digital is not the only answer. It's probably certainly part of the answer, but how would you think about that process of helping imbue this was meaning that this tragedy that's happening right now is not forgotten in the busy news cycle. Even in our generation, which, as we know, it's sort of fatigue of Syria has happened, and it's, oh, all of a sudden Syria is back. We're kind of remembering all the atrocities that have been going on there. So we don't want that to happen with Ukraine. What do you think we should be doing, could be doing in terms of that communication and bringing it to life for the generations to come?
I think it's important to define the goal on the short-term and long-term perspective, because in short-term perspective, we're speaking about the war which is still going on. And as a human rights lawyer, I want not just to document these war crimes, I want to stop it. And I believe that people in different countries have power to help me to stop these Russian war crimes. And that is why, in this short-term perspective, I think in order to understand what's going on, we need more broader picture. Let me try to explain. I live in Kyiv, and my native city is constantly being shelled not just by Russian rocket, but also by Iranian drones. Iran provided Russia with drones and rockets, as well as North Korea provided Russia with rockets. And recently, you know that North Korea sent thousands of their troops to Russia. China helps Russia to avoid sanctions and import technologies critical to warfare. And before Assad regime was fallen, Syria supported Russia in all voting in UN General Assembly. We are dealing with the formation of entire authoritarian bloc, because Iran, North Korea, China, Russia, Syria, before Assad regime was fallen, all these regimes, they have something in common. They have the same idea what a human being is, They deny people and human rights and freedom, and they have the same intent to forcibly impose a new world order where people have no protection from their authoritarian governments. And in this regard, it's not just a war between two states, Russia and Ukraine. This is a war between two systems, authoritarianism and democracy. And that's why the result of this war is so important, because Ukraine is not a goal for Russia and for Russian authoritarian alliance. Ukraine is a tool how to break the existing rule-based international order, which is not perfect, but still it have human rights and values in the core, at least in the declarations and conventions, in the wording. The new world order, which Russia and China and North Korea are promoting, it will be disaster for entrepreneurship, for development of people, for human dignity, for security of people, for freedom at all. And this is a huge problem, because last year we have half of population in the earth who went to election. But don't be naive. 80% of people in the world live in non-free or partially free societies. It means that people who last year had a real right to vote, for whom they want to vote, a minority, just 20%. We're losing freedom as phenomena. And because we live in a very interconnected world, it's a problem not just for Ukraine. It's a problem for everyone. You can't build a paradise, even being an island, when the world is bleeding.
But this is a complex topic, and I'm curious to get your take on two themes. So the notion that, for example, as an American, I would say America, when it's convenient for America, supports democratic regimes, and what's convenient for American foreign policy, as a student of foreign policy, will partner with non-democratic, quote unquote, authoritarian regimes. They may not be the meanest and the most atrocious abusers of human rights, but they would not fit into the American notion of freedom of women, freedom of self-determination for individuals, regimes. And yet they are allies. And that was very clearly in the anti-Soviet bloc had a lot of authoritarian regimes that just shared that ideology. So in that kind of messy world, right, can we still work with the paradigm that you're introducing of like authoritarian, all bad, right? Democracy, all good, right? Like obviously we talk democracies have their own problems, and now that's, some of these problems are sort of embarrassing, so that, it's becoming harder to say, look at us, we got everything worked out, to an outside world. And then the second theme, which maybe we'll cover in a little bit, but it's related, is that obviously in an ideal world, we live in a world of peace. And everybody's eager to get to the peaceful resolution in Ukraine. But in a messy world of foreign policy that I studied at university and you did, the opposite of war is not peace. The opposite of war is a state of no war. So how do we deal with these grays, right? Like where we're going to have imperfect neighbors, whatever the state is, Russia, under Putin at least, right? It's going to be an imperfect neighbor, even whatever the outcome is. And we need to still deal with it because we all have families there. You have colleagues and human rights that are there, that there's this sort of reality of the world that we still need to negotiate with people we don't like, with regimes that are not fitting into our ideals. It's hard to ask you this because you're in a state of defending and fighting and it's but in the longer term, if you stepped out of the current situation of Ukraine, how do we deal with these complexities of a gray, messy world.
Thank you. I will try to respond to these very complicated questions. And first, I will start that I don't say that democracy are ideal countries. I just say that for people who live in the country, democracy is much secure regime to how to govern society. Because you at least have some influence. You at least can have some instrument how to protect yourself. In authoritarian regime, you are object of control. You have no rights, no freedom. And that's why we see this chain of terror, when first who organized terror becomes the secondary victims of this terror machine. No one's secure, no one's secure, regardless on the place. It's a terrible and very dangerous for people model of governing society. So I just say that even from pragmatic point of view, democracies are much more secure because during democracies, people more tend to solve problems with existing legal or diplomatic or cultural or other mechanisms, not through violence, which is unfair for vast majority because rule of force, it just belongs to the most strongest and only for some temporary period, even for those strongest, because sooner or later you become more weak. I don't know how historians in future will call this historical period, but we happen to live in very turbulent time when the existing world order is collapsing before our eyes, when the work of UN Security Council is paralyzed, and it's very easy to predict that such fires like wars will emerge more and more often in different parts of the globe because this international wiring is faulty and sparks are everywhere. And I believe that it's American national interest to protect freedom because freedom has no limitation in national borders. And this is something which is bipartisan, which has to be the goal for Democrats and Republicans in the United States to protect freedom, to protect something which make United States a country which we have it for current moment, which all plus and minus, but with Silicon Valley, because even when we take example of Silicon Valley, only when you have this free environment, you can plant tech ideas which and startups and which you can lose for sure, but you can also have a chance to succeed in your entrepreneurship. And also you have the legal infrastructure how to defend your property, defend your intention. But in authoritarian and partially free societies, you have no such a chance. I work in bank field when I was a student, and I remember what does it mean when even the big banks have no possibility to defend themselves, and the owners have no possibility to defend their property when authoritarian regime decided something. So
it's a convenient but a shaky foundation. It could be convenient at times. It may be.
I just want to tell that business has also to defend freedom because freedom provides the possibility for business to flourish. And in this regard, taking about next part of your question, I think we have to define properly what peace doesn't mean and what war doesn't mean. I think we have problems with these terms because peace is not just absence of the war. It's not just a state when armies stop fighting. Peace means the possibility for people to live without fear of violence, like a freedom to live without fear of violence and to have a long-term perspective. And that's why when we look to a lot of countries in the globe, They have no aggressors who invaded them, but there is no peace inside societies because there are a lot of violence.
It's very interesting that you bring it up and pulling it up out of Ukraine. For example, for people that go to places in Africa who have not been in some countries like Ethiopia, it's amazing to see the short-term mindset that people bring to lives that don't have stability, because it's everything becomes kind of what do I do to survive? And there's no long-term, it's harder to build long-term relationships. And it just pervades the attitude of everybody around you. So part of it is economic, part of it is, a broader social stability. And it sounds like what you're saying is that the it's just very hard to build a society, and life with maximum human dignity in the situation of, instability and war, a constant set of worries.
And returning to the term of war,
Yeah.
because we also have to define the war properly. I know that people understand that the war is going on only when the bombs fall on their own heads. But the war has different dimensions, not just military. The war has economic dimension, digital dimension, informational dimension, values dimension. And in this regard, the war has no limitation in national borders. We now have a lot of examples when Russia provided harm to society in United States, when
Yeah.
Russia and China tried to find a weak point in American societies and to play in their own game with using informational field as a battlefield. We have to rethink our approach, what the war is about and what the peace is about.
So let's build on that note of informational war, the propaganda. It's obviously very difficult to get complex messages out in the world which relies on sound bites, and particularly in the US. I think there's a lot of like the part of the cost of democracy and part of the cost of free rights like freedom of speech is an environment that's very noisy. And I think you even described it yourself in one of your interviews as post-knowledge environment where people seek simple answers to complex problems. So what can we do to share more robust, more complete answers and help build societies, whether they're quote unquote thriving democracies or emerging ones that are well equipped to not to be swayed by the soundbite of the day. And by the way, democracies, that's one of the dangers, right? Because once you get people railed up on whatever issue, democracies have a harder time coming to peace eventually. They may not start wars, but the population historically does not come to once it's activated, it seeks justice, not a practical accommodation. And so that are the challenges of informational war and democracy in the informational war. What are your thoughts on what we could be doing to enable democracies to not shoot themselves in the foot?
I think that a person who find the answer to a question will receive the Nobel Peace Prize. I'm sure in it, because there is no clear solution. The answer is very abstract. People have to take responsibilities because all these problems can't be fixed just by technologies. What do I mean? What we see for current moment, according to the last year report, we have more and more people in the earth who have access to internet, and half of these people spend a lot of time in social networks. And I also saw this number that Every adult who have access to internet spent in internet at least 7 hours per day, which means that digital reality become very important for us. For some people, it's more important than real life, the digital life. And our digital reality is very polluted. Very polluted with disinformation, with anger, with hate, with different campaigns, which is conducted by politicians or by business or by states, and people are unprepared to live in such digital reality because sometimes I have a feeling that people lose this ability to provide a clear distinction between lie and truth. And with the era of deepfake, it's become more and more difficult to make these distinctions between lie and truth. And what we have as a result, even in a small community, we have people who have no shared realities because they belong to different informational bubbles.
Different, right?
In one small community, they have no shared reality. When you have no shared reality, you have no common actions to solve a real problems. How you can have a real common actions when you have no shared reality? It's impossible because you see problems very differently. And if you have no common actions, sooner or later you will lose democracy. So it's a real threat. And that's why I told that someone who find a way how to change human behavior and how to help people to provide this distinction between lie and truth in our post-informational world will get the Nobel Peace Prize, I'm sure.
Well, this is encouraging, and what we will we'll try to, and by in my other head it relate to, we'll try to throw our hat in, at least from a technology perspective, into this journey, because I think what's really important is to hear maybe short pockets of this conversation. We'll get that out, but so that people catches their attention, but then provide a broader narrative of the work that you're doing, the evidence behind it. So you probably still need to have ability to engage people and interest them, but not just was a soundbite alone, was a or was AI, right? But was the evidence and great depth underneath that to surpass this mistrust and the bubbles that we live in. And on that note, I think I would say there's one document that I think everybody who's listening should trust. And that's the annual report of your amazing work, and I hope you can support it. I'll just share it. We'll share also in the notes to the YouTube and other podcast platforms. This is the Center for Civil Liberties that Alexandra leads. This is the English version of their annual report, and you can consume. And understand the data of the organizational the challenges and everything that you're doing. If you don't want to read the whole report, you could ask it questions. So we're going to provide that to our audience so they could go and, if they can't participate themselves or can't visit Ukraine quite this year, that they could support you and the great work that you're doing, bringing truth in this informational and real war that we live in right now. Thank you, Alexandra, so much for joining us today.
Thank you for this opportunity.
Is there any other last words or messages that you want to share with our audience on how they
Yes,
can get
there is
engaged and
one.
involved?
For me, the war is not just a period of horror and losses, but also a period of gratitude. I want to express my sincere gratitude to all people in the United States and other countries who support us in this dramatic time of our history, who support our fight for freedom. I'm very grateful. We survived because of you. Thanks.
And thank you, Alexandra. You inspire us to do extraordinary things. Thank you. Welcome back. Alex Shevelenko here. Thank you so much for listening to Experience Focused Leaders podcast. You can learn more about us at podcast.relayto.com, relayto.com. Obviously, we would love for you to send this to people that you know who would be great speakers, or just share the nuggets that you took away from this episode with your community on social. And you could learn more about what we're up to on relayto.com. You could certainly connect with me on LinkedIn, where it's just very easy to spell my name. You have to have a master's in Ukrainian. It's Shevelenko, Shevelenko. Would love to connect so that we can move together the way the world communicates about its most important ideas. Thank you for listening. We hope to see you next time.